to wait for this to load. Okay. So I get to shift hats from moderator to presenter, and I have to talk a little bit about some of the work in Morse. And first I want to acknowledge my awesome co-author, Nancy Barber. She's a wonderful woman. So talking a little bit about carbon storage, greenhouse gases, and looking at a managed perennial system and comparing that within and to some other annual systems as well. I'm guessing many of you are aware that switchgrass and big bluestem are being looked at as potential bioenergy feedstocks. As a perennial grass, they're expected to store carbon in the soil. But there's not much known about what's going to happen if we're going to manage these as bioenergy crops. We're going to have to add some fertilizer because you can't take something away and not give something back. So we need to look at that. And will we be able to get enough carbon stored to offset what we anticipate is increased in nitrous oxide emissions? So really, we need to take a look at that. And then how does that compare to the business as usual in many places, which is a corn-soybean rotation? So we took advantage of some plots that we had in Morse that were established quite a few years ago. And so we have some long-term, well-established plots so we could look at three different objectives. One was looking at comparing these grasses grown with a legume as a companion crop or with nitrogen fertilizer. The second objective was looking at the timing of when these grasses were harvested, either in the autumn or in the spring. And the third is to kind of look at it from a systems perspective of these perennial systems compared to a no-till corn-soybean rotation. And in Minnesota, no-till is not common. It's still there, and maybe 5% if we're lucky. If I drive across the landscape, there's not much, a lot less moldboard plowing, but no-till just hasn't really taken off. So these were done at the Swan Lake Experimental Farm in Stevens County, Minnesota, which is in western Minnesota, so I'm quite familiar with how things get in Saskatchewan. It's, you know, we're just a little further south. So these were randomized complete block. We had full four replications. The grasses were originally planted in 2000. Harvest in the comparing fall and spring began in the fall of 2007. These are glacial till soils, tend to have very rich soil organic carbon in the topsoil, declining. Surface soil is about pH of 7 and increasing as you go with depth. We used a native type of big bluestem. Switchgrass was a sunburst, which at the time was the recommended cultivar. Remember, these were planted in 2000. For the years that we were measuring nitrous oxide, this is the urea that was applied as broadcast on there, because this is a perennial system, no way to incorporate those, or we had the clover that had been planted previously. Whether it was fall or spring, they were cut, mowed, and baled to remove that biomass from those fields. Annual systems, for the 3 years that we were looking at it, we were soybean, corn, soybean. So not all phases were present each year, so we did rotate. The corn had a starter followed by a split application using a soil test to decide how much nitrogen to apply as anhydrous ammonia. And in 2010, that was 128 kilograms per hectare. Soybeans received a small amount of nitrogen in the starter fertilizer, and that was the only nitrogen applied there. We did have soil samples that were collected in 2000. This is my co-author here, Nancy Barber. So she's out there in the, can see how dark and wonderful these topsoils are. And so the samples were originally taken in 2000, 2006, and again in 2011. We took incrementally down to 100 centimeters bulk density. Total and organic soil organic carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium were determined. Nitrous oxide, we used the GraceNet protocols that you can find in Parkins and Venturia in 2010, closed vented chambers. So two spots in each plot of the perennial grasses, and then two selective spots in the annual crops. We were next to a row and then the inner row because we anticipated some inter-row variability there to try to capture some of that, using an integrated sampling approach to try to optimize human and fiscal resources to cover the cost of doing this and balancing that against trying to capture episodic events without going out there and routinely measuring non-detects. It's kind of hard to get enthused when you go out and there's, oh, non-detect, not fun. Always had 4 sampling time points. Took the samples back to the lab, ran them on our GC, electron capture, standard rate, ran them through a nice little algorithm that we had in SAS to see if whether our best fit was linear or quadratic models, selecting the highest R-squared, modified by Venturia's recommendations. Then those were ground truth by actually looking at all of those little graphs to make sure that the SAS model was doing what we thought it was doing. Calculated cumulative emissions by linear interpolation and calculated emission factors after subtracting the background, assuming the background as a non-detect baseline as a fraction of the applied fertilizer. So take a deep breath. I'm going to be spending a little time on this very busy graph. If we start on the bottom, that graph C, take a note at the scale. That's going from 0 to 400, whereas the top two with the perennial grasses are going from 0 to 4,000. So we have an order of magnitude difference in our scales here. That's the first thing to point out. The two blue arrows down in the very bottom there are pointing to our spring thaws that Keith was asking about earlier. Now that's following a legume. And we've seen that in other studies in Morse, that when we're coming out of a legume, we have more substrate available. So yes, we do see this spring thaw flux that happens, not so much after corn. So if you've taken up most of the nitrogen, it's not available, you have less substrate to drive that spring flux. You'll also notice the downpointing arrows. I'm a little leery to try my pointer here because it keeps advancing on me. The downpointing arrows, you can see in 2010, we did have a response to the fertilizer that was applied as anhydrous ammonia. So yes, we did see two types of fluxes in our annual system, one associated in the spring flux following a legume, and the second with fertilizer. We didn't see any spring fluxes underneath our perennial grasses, perhaps because they are not legumes. Even with our growing our clover in those plots, which are a legume, because we didn't kill them, they weren't giving up all that nitrogen perhaps. So very, very minimal flux under those systems at any time. Where we applied fertilizer, yep, we got nice peaks. I don't know if nice is the right word because you don't want that nitrogen going off, but we did see responses. The small response that we see to fertilizer in 2009 we attributed to the very dry conditions at that point. Yes, there was a peak, but it was dwarfed by what we see in 2010 and 2011. So yes, there was a peak, but it was much smaller in those dry conditions as one might expect. If we kind of clump this all together and interpolate over that, 3 major results. First, we'll look at comparing what we've seen with the grasses to the corn-soybean rotation. So on average, you know, with the soybean, corn, soybean, we had about just a little under 12 megagrams per hectare per year attributed to the nitrogen, which is about 2% of the nitrogen that was applied. Remember, that's going to get tipped up a bit because we only put on a small amount in the soybean phase, so that nitrous oxide coming off bumps up the percentage. If we only look at corn, then we're right really close to the IPCC emission factor of 1%. So in this example, it actually matched, which is, it's got to be right sometimes or they wouldn't use it. Yeah, well, we could go into averages, but that's another story. Looking at autumn versus spring, so this is either harvesting the perennial grass in the fall or waiting until harvesting it in the spring. We didn't really anticipate seeing this change because this is primarily driven by just the fertilizer application, but harvesting in the spring, we had pretty substantially higher nitrous oxide fluxes in those treatments than we did when we harvested in the fall. Now, if that changed some of our distribution of how the crop was growing, I'm not sure if there were changes in microclimate that we haven't taken into account. It opens up lots of potential questions on digging into why that may have been. And if you look at the amount of fertilizer, the emission factors there, they're really quite high. And I think it really points to the fact that we need to do some basic agronomy on how to manage these crops as bioenergy and how to get that nitrogen on so we're finding the four R's for these perennial crops. And again, if we looked at the clover, comparing fertilizer to clover systems, we just really didn't get much nitrous oxide coming off when we interseeded there. Another busy figure here. Lots of information packed into this one graph. So this is looking at, again, we wanted to compare if we're going to have more nitrous oxide coming off, could we sequester enough carbon in the soil? So we did measure at different time points. Everything has been put on an equivalent basis here. So we're looking at megagrams of CO2 equivalents per hectare per year. So the first column is looking at the nitrous oxide emission. And at all times, if it's a positive value, it means there's an increase in the atmospheric CO2 equivalents. A negative means that there's a decrease. So nitrous oxide, of course, will be a positive value. If we're looking only at the soil organic carbon accumulation in the 0 to 5 centimeters, so that's just the top, we're building a nice duff layer, pretty much in all of these systems, we actually were showing a slight increase in our soil organic carbon in the top 5 centimeters. Not very much, but it's expected. Because remember, we went from being in a tilled system in our annual to no-till in 2000, so this is integrating over that whole time. And those values that have the little star next to them, those are also significantly different from zero. The 0 to 5 is the only increment that we could actually detect significant differences. We looked at it 0 to 30, and at the 0 to 100, at those intervals, they were not significantly different than zero. So if you take the difference between the nitrous oxide coming off, the sequestration of CO2 into the soil, for most of these systems only accounting for what's going on in the 0 to 5, we didn't have enough sequestration to offset the amount of nitrous oxide that came off these plots. If we look at what was going on in the whole profile down to 100 centimeters, at least arithmetically, it suggests that maybe we are. Now, statistically, we haven't been able to pick this up as a difference from zero, partly because of the high variability. Again, these are glacial till soils, and our depth, soil profile depth, is incredibly variable as we go across a plot not any bigger than this room. You might have depth of your topsoil 20 centimeters in one place and 30 in another. That makes even GPSing and going back very difficult to get really precise values. Some interesting things to note, though, that these perennial systems kind of in general look like they might be mitigating a bit as compared to our corn-soybean rotation that's now in a no-till. If we look at the nitrous oxide offset, it suggests arithmetically that there may be some, but I'd be very cautious because none of those are statistically different from zero. Looking at yields, I'm not going to spend much time on this because I've gotten my two-minute warning and I know we're all hungry. But pretty much what we've seen is that when we went with the legume, the problem is that we decrease yield. We didn't have quite enough nitrogen being provided in that legume system. It didn't have as much biomass. So from an industry standpoint, that's not desirable. Now, the corn did very well. Looking at below-ground biomass, again, we had a lot of below-ground biomass to help build the carbon, and that carbon is not included in those soil organic carbon values. Those roots were very carefully removed. So where does this leave us? Yep, we could measure sequestration in the top 5 centimeters, not so much deeper, even though we anticipated it. It just wasn't measurable there. So the soil carbon storage, even under these perennials that are managed as a bioenergy, may not be adequate enough to offset the nitrogen flux. So we really need to be very careful and improve our nitrogen management so we reduce that nitrous oxide flux as much as possible. and I need to acknowledge, you know, the army of people that go out. I don't even have the undergraduates listed here, just the technical people. And certainly recognize Don Murkowski, who initially set these out several years before I retired, and I get to reap the benefits because I inherited these awesome plots. And this work was recently published earlier this year in one of the Society Journal. So, awesome. Any questions? Do I have time for a question or two, Virginia? Okay. It's, yeah, you know, I stand between you and lunch. Keith.
No, great presentation. So how confident are you that your nitrogen application is kind of at the industry production optimal?
I'm pretty confident we're not.
So
I think we did
our... under-fertilizing or over-fertilizing from the standpoint of production?
I think we might be in terms of production close, but I think it's in terms of timing and getting that aspect right, not quite. I think the absolute amount might be close, but getting the timing and the formulation right, I think we have room for improvement.
That's kind of, if I just continue that, do you think that emission factor of 2 or over 2% could be brought down then with better end management in terms of timing or amount?
I think so. And you think about all the years and the studies that have gone into refining our best management practices for something like corn or wheat, and we just don't have that background in the agronomy for some of these perennial systems. There's lots of room for improvement. I think that's the bottom line. I think there was a question over here first.
Yeah, maybe I just missed it, but what explained the order of magnitude difference with the emissions from the perennial grasses?
I think partly it was the management timing, is that we used urea on the perennial grasses that you apply, and then you will wait for it, or you try to time it when you know it's going to rain. You get a pretty substantial rain, now you're going to have pockets for denitrification that can really drive emission. And if we're not taking it up quite in the right timing, you're setting yourself up for a lot of flux. Good question. In the back?
Since you're applying your urea fertilizer broadcasting into the calcareous soil, have you explored ammonia volatilization at all?
We did not. We were not set up to be able to look at that. That's a really good question. Like many of you, if you drive by a field when they've applied urea and the conditions aren't quite right, you see all this ammonia coming off where you can actually visualize it. I mean, we didn't see that, but it's certainly a potential. Good question.
Your emission factor was, one of your emission factors was 27.
Pardon?
27.
It was about 2 point something on average for the perennial grasses. So it was about 2. No, there was a decimal in there. I'd be having a heart attack if our emission factor was almost 30%. All right, any other questions? If not, please have an awesome lunch, but come back, because we continue this discussion promptly at 1:30.